But welcome to the show, Alan. I'm excited to talk to you. You were very kind enough to interview me for your wonderful article on Borat. For people who don't know you, do you want to introduce yourself and talk a little bit about your work, your training? I think you're also like me. You and I are we are from the academic world. We could use the word refuse, but I won't because that's mean.
I mean, yeah, thanks for having me on. I guess we could maybe call ourselves refugees from academia. Yeah, I was training for a while. It's my PhD at Glasgow University, and I was kind of training to be a sociologist or somebody in journalism studies or maybe politics or Latin American studies. And I finished in 2017, or maybe it was 2018 now. But yeah, the world of academia is a really cutthroat one, very hard to get on, especially if you don't have contacts, especially if you have the wrong politics, etc. I wrote a couple of books about the media that came out of my PhD, and it soon became clear that academic publishing was also a scam, whereby Routledge, the company who I signed with, weren't really that interested in really promoting it or anything. So I thought I better do my own promotion. And part of that was basically writing plugs for the book in the form of articles for various websites that I thought might be interested in them. And yeah, I did that thinking I was doing it for free, but I actually got a check back from one of them for a few hundred dollars, which is actually, in the end, probably about as much as I actually have made from the books themselves for this like one article that I thought I was doing for free. So that was really my first kind of move towards actually working in journalism rather than academia. I thought, well, if I got a few hundred dollars for that, let's try and bastardize a chapter of this other book that I've written and send it to them. And they were like, yeah, we'll publish that as well. And I thought, right, well, this is good. I'm getting paid as much as I did in my crappy job working in a museum. So maybe I'll just keep on going with this. And from there, Mint Press News contacted me and asked me to write a couple of articles. And since then, I've moved on to become the senior staff writer there and the podcast producer as well. So you can find all my work at Mint Press News, or you can also follow me at Twitter at Alan R. McLeod.
That was very good, very polished. I would never be able to do that in such a concise way. I wanted to talk about the insanity of the last 6 months, because I'm still not over the fact that we've watched liberals our whole lives proclaim their moral red lines, you know, and sort of proclaim that, oh, these things are bad, like censorship is bad, terrorism is bad. And yet, what we've seen over the last 6 months is, yeah, it's okay to shutter news organizations, it's okay to bully them when you don't like what they say because they scare you. And the deplatforming has been so, so intense. And Mint Press has felt it, you personally have felt it. And I guess my first question would be like, what's it like to sort of make them so mad? Does it make you happy? It would make me happy personally to make so many loser libs as mad as like you and Mint Press make them.
Yeah, I don't know. They do sort of come after us an awful lot. Yeah, if people don't know, I did get banned from PayPal. The story about it is pretty weird. It was just in the wake of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Me, Mint Press's CEO, Manar Adli, Consortium News, and a bunch of other journalists all got banned pretty much on the same day from PayPal. Completely out of the blue, I received an email from PayPal saying that they were going to be closing my account. And I actually thought it was to do with me not using the account. But when I opened up the email, it said there was been suspicious activity, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm looking at this and I went back through my receipts and I found that I hadn't actually received money from that account into that account since July of last year. So that was, what, 10 months or so? And I hadn't even used it since December of that year, so at least 4 months. And the only transactions I'd made was to buy like, you know, USB cable off of eBay or some cheap headphones or something. Nothing above like $6 or something. So this was clearly a targeted attack on a lot of anti-war writers and journalists and news outlets who were not toeing the line on Ukraine. I mean, I'm not, you know, a supporter of Russia by any means. I think what they did was a clear violation of international law and should be condemned. But at the same time, I'm not going to pretend like Ukraine is this, you know, field full of happy, lovable social democrats and everything is perfect there. So people taking up a sort of principled anti-war stance whereby they're worried about what Russia is doing, they're worried about what NATO is doing as well, and they're talking about both of those things just get zapped. And a couple of months later, we find out through emails that it might have actually been Nina Yankovic, the disinformation czar herself, who got kicked out very quickly through this big right-wing pressure campaign when Joe Biden announced that she was going to become this disinformation expert who was going to... It was kind of unclear what she was actually going to do, but it really did sound like a ministry of truth. It sounds like I was probably the only one of her victims. But certainly... this sort of censorship is really tough, and it's compares into nothing compared to what big outlets like Google or Facebook have done to Mint Press in the past, which has basically been to de-rank them completely. So this is, by the way, happened to so many websites, not just Mint Press, but Mint Press lost nearly 90% of its Google traffic overnight after Google changed its algorithms to promote establishment content and demote what they called borderline content. But it didn't just happen to Mint Press. You know, Alternet lost 63% of its Google search traffic overnight. Democracy Now! Lost 36%. The Intercept lost 19%. And there was even an article in the Wall Street Journal talking with Mark Zuckerberg, where he specifically said that even Mother Jones had been targeted for their left of center political beliefs, and they were being deranked on Facebook as well. So if you think about how milquetoast and liberal an outlet like Mother Jones is, knowing that Mark Zuckerberg himself is personally targeting them and demoting them, what do you think they're doing to actual radical scholars or anti-imperialists or genuine alternative media? And that's the sort of landscape we're living in. In the 2010s, the early 2010s, there was this sense that this was this brave new world where things were really possible and you could build websites and connect with people all around the world and build a huge audience like that. And to a certain extent, that was true. There was something of a, if not a golden age, maybe we'll say, a less shit age than we are in now. But that quickly, turned around after the 2016 election, whereby it seems that the powers that be decided that fake news, and particularly fake news emanating from Russia, was the reason that Hillary Clinton lost the election, not because she had terrible politics and policies, or she didn't campaign in Wisconsin or any of the key battleground states, or that she screwed over Bernie Sanders and the left. Nothing like that. It was disinformation that your grandma was reading on Facebook that made them vote Republican, even though, they've probably been doing that for the last 30, 40 years anyway. And yeah, they took the opportunity to really retighten their grip over the means of communication, whereby they started planting national security state agents into big organizations like Google and Facebook and Twitter and Reddit and pretty much every big social media outlet. And they also changed the rules of the game radically, whereby advertising was pulled from alternative media. And the situation now is that these online behemoths like Google and Facebook are really attacking any sort of alternative media out there while promoting like conservative and even reactionary stuff. I always say it's harder for a camel to pass through the eye of the needle than it is for YouTube to stop recommending you Ben Shapiro videos, because it really is extraordinary. Like, if you just create an account and just see the sort of things that it will start firing at you immediately, you're not going to be getting anti-imperialist content, radical content, leftist, Marxist, anarchist, whatever. You're going to be presented with what the biggest corporations in the world feel is conducive to their needs, or basically acceptable to them, which means anything from centrist to pretty much far right is fine with them. Basically, any political force that does not challenge the status quo and their dominance as these multi-billion dollar behemoths, which basically control the way we communicate with each other now.
There's so much to say. I think at the outset, though, is whenever I talk to journalists that have been attacked in the way you guys have been attacked, I just say, like, oh, you guys are Iranian now too. Because in the sense that the idea, like the way that the U.S. has treated Iran, the Islamic Republic, since the revolution, more or less, has been this escalating game of you're out, like you're out of the system, you're out of this world that I live in. You know, I'm taking my ball and I'm going home. And this kind of exclusionary practice of like the U.S. empire and like, you know, the Western sort of states, the idea that, oh, you don't deserve a space in my precious public sphere is how it articulates itself in the kind of media world we live in now, that there is this privilege that to be part of the so-called public sphere, which I don't think exists, which is like a fiction and probably always has been, but like to participate in it, you need to be sort of some medallion carrying like normie who abides by like the normie sources. So Washington Post, New York Times. And yet you have to somehow make a career in this. You have to sort of tell people that like, okay, that's not how the world works. And here's some alternative views. And what's been nuts is that like that they had to go to such lengths to exclude like just one website, two websites, five websites. And so many of them, like Mother Jones, as you said, are like hardly like, you know, gut punch like directories. Like a lot of them are sort of like for these aging boomer readers who are mostly libs now, who are like, you know, living in a few parts of the US or whatever, and kind of international readers that remember that era. But like nobody under the age of 50 reads like boomer, like, you know, The Nation or something. Like that stuff is all sort of from a dinosaur age. And the fact that they like clamp down on any website, any source that gathers up any kind of steam, I'm like, quite frankly, I don't know how you have your Twitter account still. Like, haven't they found some excuse? I guess you're very careful. I've noticed you're very careful, but like they'll find an excuse to kick you out. I guess my question is, what's the contingency now for you and for places like Mint Press? Like, how do you think you can survive in this? Because they're going to come after you. Like, it'll get worse. It doesn't get better from here. It gets worse, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you have to realize that this sort of era that I was talking about, whereby we were able to build up, build up our following in, you know, the early 2010s, that was always kind of the sort of golden era, let's say, whereby it was never going to last. You know, the biggest capitalist corporations in the world, many of them own the media outlets. I'm thinking about places like Google, like Microsoft, like Facebook. They were never going to allow us to use their platforms to spread anti-capitalist propaganda that ultimately would threaten their bottom line. So we're always fighting on an uphill battle when we're using these platforms. Unfortunately, they become so ubiquitous that we really have to be on there, because there's no alternative to Twitter or alternative to Facebook, really. There are sort of attempts to do this, but really their value is in the fact that everybody is there, rather than, you know, it's very easy. You can find, if you want to communicate with someone, it's very easy to just, you know, set up an email account with one of thousands of different email providers for free and send someone an email. But actually trying to reach a broad audience means we kind of have to play by their rules. And I, as you said, I'm very careful on Twitter. I don't swear. I almost never get into arguments with people. You know, I'm kind of careful about what I say. I don't attack people personally or anything. Certainly self-censor, of course, as well. So, you know, the long-term strategy is that we do have to start building platforms, not only online, but also offline. I think, you know, online organizing is kind of a pale substitute for real face-to-face activism, but, you know, it's worth doing regardless. And in the short term, you have to put your eggs in as many baskets as possible, so you're not just totally reliant on, you know, your Twitter account or your YouTube account, because that can be taken away from you immediately. And people who work in alternative media are painfully aware of this, that, you know, these pressure points in their business that can be got after. You know, sometimes it's advertising, or sometimes it's, you know, the big service providers that will just zap a company and take them off. And that's one reason why you have to try and diversify as much as possible, get into, you know, I've just started a Telegram channel, or get into as many different platforms as possible. But also, I think going back to email lists is really important as well, whereby you actually control that list. It's not just, you know, Facebook decides one day that actually your 500,000 followers, we're not going to allow you to message them or send them content. Your stuff's not going to appear on their feeds. Yeah, I mean, we're in a really perilous, terrible time for media right now. As one system dies, the old media, and the new one starts to be born. But unfortunately, this new one is generating monopolies that are much larger and much more dangerous than the ones that came before it. You know, Ben Bagdikian wrote a great book called The New Media Monopoly, originally about how just 55 companies owned 90% of the US media landscape. And I think by the time he's updated to his last one, it says only six companies now own this enormous amount of the offline media landscape. But when we look online, there's just these enormous behemoths that have been allowed to spring up. You know, Facebook now has 3 billion, or is it between 3 and 4 billion users monthly, which means that something like 35 to 45% of the entire world is on there, meaning that they're getting their news from one source, which is essentially in control of what the world thinks and does. So we have to be cognizant of this, and we also have to start developing strategies, whether that's building platforms ourselves or trying to find new platforms for alternative ways to reach people. But ultimately, we are definitely playing on their field, if you want to put it like that, meaning that the internet is really being stitched up in terms of the big companies owning and controlling it. And of course, these companies have very close links with the US national security state as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is, to go back to my previous point, is that this is the perennial experience that a lot of people from Iran have. Like, they shut down press TV. Like, this was during the Trump time. Like, I was thinking about it, there's dozens, hundreds of media outlets that is targeted at Iran and Iranians, spreading all kinds of whatever, like, just hundreds of them, thousands probably, if you include Telegram channels. And yet, like, here's one, you know, one little English broadcaster, Press TV, and they can't even have a website. Like, the U.S. Treasury Department hounds them for having one bloody website. So it makes me wonder, like, is this a mark of insecurity? Like, are they just so, like, afraid of sites like of Mint Press? Like, is it just, why is it so unconscionable for liberals? And it's the liberal class, really. Because they own the media worlds that we're from. They own the academy that trained us. Like, I did my PhD too. Like, I was raised by liberals there. And they own the tech companies and the boards and the media corporations, like that kind of, which is not to say they're hostile to conservative politics, but they're sort of, they're liberals in the sense that they think in this way of like, oh, these are my morals, because liberals like love to tell you their morals. And then they'll tell you also, oh, but they don't count in the case of X, Y, and Z, right? And this, it makes me wonder, like, is it just that they're petty and they just don't want to give their enemy any kind of advantage, any kind of space? Or is it that they're afraid, you know, is it that they're so deathly afraid of having worldviews given to them that don't align with their own kind of bifurcation of the world into liberals and conservatives? Because I sometimes think that, like, liberals think that way, that there's like only one other contingent of people out there, and those are called conservatives, and they hate the things that I love. And then there's the rest of us to their left flank who are just freaks and tankies and losers and marginal. And who knows, they may be right. We may be so marginal, and that's why they can bully us. That's why they can step on us like ants.
Yeah, I guess ultimately, I think it's a real totalitarian mindset whereby, as you were saying, you can own the means of communication, blitz people with propaganda, but one alternative view has to be absolutely stamped out. This has been going on for decades, of course, in the UK. People with radical politics who get elected, often not allowed on the BBC. If they are on there, they'll be attacked, they'll be, you know, teamed up on against in any sort of debate. It happens inside of news institutions as well. The BBC, of course, famously reported on itself, saying that at very least until 1989, every major position at the company, any sort of influential position, every person had to be vetted by MI5, the Secret Service, before they were allowed to take that role. And the BBC asked, does this still go on? And MI5 refused to answer, which basically means, yes, it does. And ultimately, I think it's a test of how unsturdy and how paper thin their ideology is in its entirety, that if people were exposed to alternative ideas, they fear that they would have no answer for that. And that really came out in an interesting way recently in the Paul Mason leak emails, whereby he was talking to some British intelligence aligned official, actually talking about Mint Press and how they had to challenge us and how they, you know, find some way of shutting us down, basically. And he basically said that there is a radical thread within these alternative media outlets, which liberalism doesn't have an answer for. And he's right, liberalism doesn't have an answer. We've seen for 40 years now, neoliberalism hold Europe and the United States, and frankly, the rest of the world as well, most of it anyway, hostage. And we've seen what the consequences are. We've seen, a flatlining of wages or even going down. We've seen entire regions of the United States and Europe destroyed, places, you know, now called the Rust Belt or, you know, anything like that, whereby factories have been moved away to Asia or Latin America, jobs have gone. All the while, certain people have become extremely wealthy and, you know, extravagantly wealthy. And people have been getting slowly, slowly more and more angry, frustrated with the status quo, to the point where belief in institutions, in their credibility, in, you know, the court system, the media, just general, the government in general, has fallen to record levels. And because liberals don't really want to give ordinary people an inch here, we've also seen the rise of the far right, because, you know, their message has been, well, you know what the problem is, it's the reason you can't get a job and your life sucks is because all these immigrants have come in. And that's at least an answer. And it's quite a shallow answer, of course, because, you know, okay, immigrants have come in the last 30 years or so, but that's certainly not the reason why, you know, the factory closed down and has moved to Vietnam or whatever. But ultimately, that's often the only message they're hearing, partly because, of course, that more radical outlets who are talking about the actual reasons this happened, which is the nature of capitalism, big governments, corporate control, etc., have been systematically shut out of the airways. And when they migrated online, they slowly got taken out there as well. So yeah, ultimately, we do have a situation whereby the enemy du jour, if their media outlet is reaching more than, you know, a few people, suddenly now seems to be that is a worthy target, whether it's RT or whether it's Press TV. Maybe in the coming years, it'll be CGTN, the Chinese state media as well, which broadcasts around the world in English. Or maybe it will be, you know, if the new administration decides to attack Venezuela, maybe Telesur will get taken off the air as well.
Yeah, I don't even know what to say at this point. Like, how do you, because remember that era of like kind of mid-Trump or early Trump, where people would, or even before he got elected too, there was this kind of strange, like Pavlovian, like response built into like millions upon millions of, I mean, who knows, maybe they were dumbass bots, like, what do I know? But like, even the big profile ones where they would say, oh, Trump's just said something, which is a direct contradiction of something he said, you know, X many days ago. Like, there was that guy who worked at the Toronto Star, Daniel Hale, I want to say his name is. He like went around and like tracked every statement that Trump made, like mapped his for truthfulness, and like would do like this daily count of like lies that Trump gave. I wanted to just take the entire like liberal world aside. It's like, do you think this matters? Like, do you really think that anybody cares that Trump is a hypocrite? And this weird sort of like double brain, like two-sided, like monster that lives inside of liberals, where on the one hand, they are all hall monitors and they love the rules and they love to scream at you about the rules and they love to talk about how they're the arbiter of those rules. And then on the other hand, because they are the arbiter of those rules, they can also decide to turn them on and off whenever they so please, or they can just keep quiet when stuff happens that's like, you know, you could just kind of like disavow it, especially because in the American political system, you can be a really angry radical against the president when it's not your guy in power, right? And like, that's just like this trading off of media cultures. So like, this is, we're sitting outside of this, like, this kind of infinitesimal, like, never-ending state fair of like carnivalesque like representation of the world. It's like, oh, here's, and like, that's what's called our news. It's like packaged into like these like hourly segments. Like in Canada, we have CBC. CBC is the most reactionary, one of the most reactionary public broadcasters in the world, I would say, in terms of like its imperialist agenda. Now it's like, and I think also that goes for NPR too, is that like when talking about especially foreign countries and like foreign policy, like what we call kind of foreign policy, which in Western kind of realm, that's a euphemism for US empire and its surrogates. Like that's just like a easy euphemism for that. Like we don't, you know, that's just over there. And it's always framed through the compradors, through whatever mission. Right now, they're screaming about Nicaragua. Did you notice that? They're screaming about Nicaragua all of a sudden, about the lack of freedom of speech and like manufacturing something there. And so this is, you know, like we are, and I unfortunately, Alex Jones ruined this term. He's a freak, but that's kind of his job. But like, this is like, we are subjects and objects of perpetual info war. That like information war is one of the most important facets of any imperial agenda and like any imperial era. And of course, like everybody's part of an info war. So like Mint Press and my show and whatever, we're part of an info war in the sense that like we have ideological commitments that we then try to negotiate and that we try to sort of articulate, that we find like interlocutors like I'm doing right now with you, who like share my views or overlap with my views, who can provide interesting sort of like, you know, new perspectives to things I had never seen before, which I think is the only sort of honest way to go. It's like, it's, you don't, the liberal myth of being neutral observer, blah blah blah, like I think that's died down in years because a lot of liberals are sort of like raging imperialist Clintonites and they don't care. But at the same time, you know, like, how do you, like, what advice would I say? I mean, you kind of answered this earlier, but maybe more direct thing. Like, young people who are starting out, like, what advice would you give them? Possibly also graduate students who are listening to this, who are pursuing their PhDs, considering a life outside of academia or journalism. You know, like, what advice would you give them to, like, survive and even thrive in the infosphere while keeping to your principles, not being a hack, not falling for every single regime change op that comes along that's thrown at you? Because these are real, you know, and another thing would be to not get wrapped up in, and I guess this is the second part of my question, like to not get wrapped up in culture war, because that seems to be so much of our information sphere, is that there are these never-ending skirmishes, like there are these, like, not never ending, sorry. There are these short-lived skirmishes that keep repeating themselves over like specific issues. So like that get certain parts of certain populations up in arms, and up in arms means online engagement, right? Because online is not the real world. We know that. So like so much of what we think of as the sort of ideological sphere or the discursive sphere is really like these kind of, you know, like carnivalesque, like, you know, publicity machines that run inside, that we're sometimes trapped inside, and then we're forced to kind of stand there with, you know, poorly Xerox socialist flyers or like the equivalent thereof, and be like, okay, rethink what you're told and whatever, until they escort you out of the park.
Yeah, I guess my advice to everybody, not just people interested in the media, is to absolutely scrutinize everything. We have to develop a nationwide, worldwide critical media literacy campaign whereby people really understand what they're reading,
they really have to think about the who, what, when, where, why of anything they're consuming. Who's making it? Why are they doing it? Where was it produced? What sort of biases does it have? Everybody has biases. I really hate the question that some people sometimes pose, which is, you know, what news source can I trust? The reality is you cannot trust anything. Every single news source, even the lovely alternative media one that's small, has its biases. I've definitely got my biases. I don't try to hide the fact, my political views. But I do think that, one of the most pernicious aspects over the last few years in media has been the rise in fact-checking and fact-checking culture, as if these people are free of biases themselves and can step out of their own ideology and try to, see the world as it really is. Ultimately, almost everybody involved in this fact-checking thing are aggressive, centrist neoliberals, and they are, in fact, pushing their own ideology and pretending and passing it off as if this is somehow just correct, like 2 + 2 = 4. Part of my PhD was looking at Antonio Gramsci and his concept of hegemony, which basically means the process by which the elite manage to convince the rest of the public that their interests, their tastes, their outlooks are just normal. They're not an ideology, they're just common sense, ultimately, and trying to get the rest of the public to see it that way. Because, of course, when you see something like centrism as the default, as the sort of thing you do if you're not biased, then ultimately that is a huge win for centrists. We've seen these fact checkers being deployed against the left terribly in the last few years. For instance, just one example, when Bernie Sanders was campaigning, the Washington Post and its fact checking team constantly went after Bernie. There was one very famous example whereby Glenn Kessler wrote an article basically insinuating that Bernie was a fraud and a liar because the title was something like, Sanders claims his average donation is $27, but his own figures don't show that. And what he found was the average Sanders donation was $27.89. Now, he knows for a fact that the vast majority of people don't read past the headline. So he knew what he was doing there. He was saying Bernie is a liar because his average donation is 89 cents more than what he's claiming, which frankly, you know, if somebody said you owe me $27 and it was actually $27.89, that would seem completely normal to everybody. That would be totally fine. But ultimately, the Post was trying to push this as some sort of, you know, gotcha moment for Bernie. And there are so many examples of this. I just recently wrote an article about the fact-checking organizations that Facebook's use in Ukraine. They recently partnered with 9 separate fact-checking organizations to try to keep Eastern Europe safe from Kremlin disinformation or any disinformation, really. But what I found was by just simply going to their websites or looking at their grants databases, that an absolute bare minimum of them, of 5 of the 9, were actually being bankrolled by the US government, either through the embassy or through the National Endowment for Democracy, which is, you know, in a sentence, it's a front group for the CIA, and it has carried out many of the worst regime change activities that the CIA has been doing. And not only that, many of the other ones that weren't directly being funded by the US government were either being funded by the British government or the Germans or the Dutch government, or had many close links with the NED as well, which strongly suggested they were also being funded by Washington as well, but I couldn't prove it. So ultimately, we've got this situation whereby fact checkers are presenting themselves as the moral arbiters of what is true and false. But the reality is that they're carrying out one of the most pernicious operations that we've seen in media in the last few years, whereby they're pretending to be our friends, but in fact, they're pushing their own ideology on us. It's as if the foxes were offering to guard the hen house against the wolves. It's, you know, frankly, absolutely crazy. And, you know, on liberalism, I feel like when you look at foreign policy, it's kind of where liberalism is kind of dashed on the rocks of the reality of what the US is doing around the world. We talk about we love democracy and we promote democracy everywhere, but our biggest friends in the Middle East are the Gulf dictatorships and also Saudi Arabia, or we talk about we love democracy, but we're overthrowing democratically elected Latin American presidents, or as you said, you know, talking about Nicaragua and its human rights record. Ultimately, if you're from the global south, and a lot of well-paid columnists in the Washington Post and the Atlantic and various other big US news outlets start talking about democracy and human rights in your country, the chances are you're probably about to get bombed. And this is about as close to a historical truism as it's possible to get in media, that the talk of human rights or women's rights or anything like that in a certain country, once it starts getting turned on, is probably getting turned on for a reason, and it's there to manufacture consent for the American public to go along with whatever the US government has in mind. Talking about manufacturing consent, I think that's an excellent book to start listening and really trying to understand how the media function. There's loads of other good books out there. Michael Parenti wrote a great book, Inventing Reality, in the 80s. You could have a look at Robert McChesney's work for something a bit more up to date as well. When you were talking about getting subsumed in the culture war, I think, you know, Twitter and YouTube and other big social media outlets, they really kind of force you into this because they've realized that that's good for their business model. Outrage sells, controversy sells, and it has a very pernicious aspect on modern society, not only into pushing people into stuff that doesn't really matter, whether it's, you know, this Hollywood movie is featuring an all-woman cast and a bunch of weird right-wing psychos are hating it or whatever, but it also pushes, and I even hate this word that I'm using it, content creators, that, you know, journalists, into covering this stuff as well, because ultimately their bottom line lives and dies by the amount of views or clicks they get. So they're constantly chasing the clicks. They're even changing the sort of content they produce in order to chase that market as well. So people aren't doing these sorts of long form investigations that, don't pay the bills, because ultimately it's one web page and it's loaded once, and you can't sell the ads on it. So you're making these little snippets or whatever. And ultimately we're kind of getting dragged down to the point where we're living in a sort of slightly dumbed down society. And, you know, I don't think that's entirely by accident. I think the powers that be, you know, quite like it like that. So, yeah, I suppose to sum up, everybody has a bias. You have to be scrutinizing how those biases play out. Really look at who owns what sort of media outlet you're reading. Who is the journalist? For what reason are they writing this? You really have to start, excuse me, you really have to start looking at these sorts of things if you want to truly understand how media works and how you are being manipulated constantly to try to get you to feel a certain way. And that's true of alternative media, it's true of state media, corporate media, whatever. Every media outlet is trying to get you to change your opinion or to see something in a different way. And because of that, I think it's just really important to take a step back and really try to observe and scrutinize dispassionately what you're reading.
Yeah, no, it's I was kind of thinking about this, you know, you and I are cursed with being, you know, subjects of the West. And so we don't have the luxury of asking this question, but I wonder sometimes that, is it good that certain states in the global South or outside of the West, like China, for instance, is it good that they throw up for their own people? Is it a good thing that they throw up these great firewalls? Because time and time again, since time immemorial, it will show that the imperialists will have there is no rock bottom that these imperialists can hit. There's nothing that they won't do to gain an advantage, to pursue their, you know, voracious needs for resources and control of the world. So is there any point even letting them in? And I wonder if the Chinese model of just like, we live in our own media sphere, you know, we are 1.5 billion Chinese speakers, we have more than enough people to create our culture, our knowledge. We don't need a huge injection from Hollywood. Now, the story of Hollywood in China is complicated. You know, it's not just simplistic like that. There's clearly a base of interest for things that are Western. However, it is tightly controlled and it's the news culture, the sort of straight up news culture that is just not a force in China. Like, it's just, they're just kept out. And you wonder, like, is that the right model? Like, Iranians, like, don't let BBC Persian or Iran International, because BBC Persian are funded by, and it's, you know, tit for tat measure too, that like, oh, you're going to expel our media services, we'll do it to you. And, you know, I think now that this idea that, you know, if the imperialists want to shut down if they want to shut every door in the face of their enemies, then it's about time that they did it to us too. That there's no reason that, like, yes, like, get the story going around a few days ago of like how hard it is for foreigners to find places in Hong Kong, how hostile they are. It's like, yeah, good. Good. I'm glad that it's hard for you to not make a life so that you can get paid by Jeff Bezos to do InfoWarrior. Sorry that it's inconvenient for you to do that. You know, like, if other people were allowed to do the same, if people could like make a normal life, if Palestinians, say, weren't hounded out of existence for just speaking up, if there weren't laws passed to say that you can't criticize Israel or you won't get funding. I mean, that's the world we live in. Like, that's the crazy upside down world we live in, where the people who lecture us about, you know, freedom of speech and censorship and this and that are the same people passing laws that say, oh, you can't question linking Zionism, being against Zionism is racist, the same thing as anti-Semitism, and you can't say that. Like, that's just straight up it. It's just like they will do anything, say anything, they will change any rule. So maybe it's just better to throw up your hands and say, okay, nothing. You get nothing. You get no access to our people. And I mean, whether or not that actually happens in real life is a different story. People are interested. And yeah, I guess I don't know enough about the Great Firewall, how it works, but I can see why that this urge to block the West is makes sense. I can see why. I mean, the West does it. You might as well do it back to them.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, especially in the West, tend to see the internet as this, you know, global means of communication, a liberatory force, which is almost entirely free. And yeah, maybe now we've got these big monopolies like Amazon or whatever, or Twitter or Facebook, and maybe that's not good. But ultimately, it's totally free and it's a really important cornerstone of democracy. But the reality is, if you read somebody like Yasha Levine's Surveillance Valley, or even just look at the work that I've been doing over the past, you know, year or so, the very nature of the internet is so fundamentally intertwined with the US national security state that it's very hard to see where one begins and the other ends. So, for instance, the work that ultimately became Google, the work that Sergey Brin did at Stanford University, according to journalist Nafees Ahmed, was not just only paid for by the CIA, but it was also overseen by the CIA, to the point where the CIA was funding or, you know, investing, helping Google in its early stages. They even owned Google shares until as late as 2005. So we've got a situation there where Google has a very close relationship with the CIA. It has, in the past few years, been openly hiring former CIA agents, a lot of them straight out of Langley. So on a Friday, they finish their job in Langley, and then on a Monday, they're now at Google headquarters in California and starting their new job. The same thing is happening with Facebook, with Twitter, with TikTok. I've been cataloging this for the last few months over at Mint Press, to the point where, as I said, these people are being parachuted in from the national security state into the biggest social media companies. And they're not being pushed into jobs that are politically neutral, things like sales or customer service or anything. They're being put in as content moderators, as trust and security advisors, the people ultimately who control what we see and what we don't see online. So the person, for instance, that Facebook presents as its face of content moderation is Aaron Berman. You might have seen him on some Facebook ads which talk about how important it is to strike a balance between letting things go and, you know, preserving free speech, but also cracking down on borderline content. Aaron Berman was, until 2019, one of the highest ranking members of the CIA. He actually wrote President Obama and President Trump's daily briefings that were read out to them in the White House. and he just skipped along from the CIA and just immediately got planted into the higher echelons of Facebook. And the reason I'm saying this is that that sort of influence, whereby Facebook and these other big social media companies are by far and away the most important and influential media outlets that have ever existed, that reach billions of people every day, including, you know, just in Facebook's case, more than a third of Iranians have Instagram, and something like a quarter of them use Facebook as well. So we've got a point where that is an incredible reach that Facebook has into global South countries, and it really constitutes a national security and a national sovereignty issue for every other country in the world, except the USA. So I do see that there are definitely pros with allowing this global means of communication to come into your country, but I do also see the cons. So I do kind of understand why China would feel like this great firewall is still a very important thing to maintain. Of course, they have this huge domestic population, as you said, that can ultimately sustain something like that. Another country that did that for a long time was Cuba, whereby they basically just didn't have the internet for the longest time. That's changed in the past few years, and almost immediately, in fact, even before the internet was widespread in Cuba, the United States government was specifically using the internet and the increased availability of the internet online to try to foment regime change there. The National Endowment for Democracy invented an app which was like a Twitter clone called Zunzunio. They marketed it as an independent app which was just really good for messaging. But the point was is that once it got to a critical mass of people, they would start feeding anti-government content into people's news feeds. And then at some point, they were planning to send messages to everybody saying, we're all going to the main square. The time is now. Let's overthrow the government. Yeah, yeah, yeah. This was exposed a couple of years later. But one thing that wasn't talked about very much was that the National Endowment for Democracy actually had a meeting with Jack Dorsey of Twitter, where they tried to get him to sign on to this project and actually buy it from them and keep it going. Now, it's not known what happened at that meeting. I did try to find out. I contacted the people. They were not talking about it. But yeah, ultimately, even now, if you talk to people in Cuba, they're talking about how now that WhatsApp is there, they are being bombarded with propaganda from Miami, from their relatives, but also people they don't know, just constantly sending them links, to the point where the amount of fake news that people believe in Cuba right now is absolutely ludicrous. And it's really constituting a very dangerous problem for society, especially in the era of COVID or anything like that, whereby they're just being fed this ludicrous, lurid nonsense 24/7. Through their phones. And, you know, as a government, you have to really look at that and say, this is a national security issue. What are we going to do about it? And even if you do ban the internet, ultimately, the National Endowment for Democracy, which I've mentioned before, is funding so many media outlets across the world, and also conduits for the US government, like the Ford Foundation or the Open Society Foundation, or anything, you know, related to Pierre Omidyar or other big billionaires. These groups are funding an enormous number of media outlets across the world, journalism outlets, which all pretty much push the same neoliberal agenda. They don't really have a domestic base for it, but because they have this you know, cash flow coming from Washington, they can sustain themselves and then become big parts of the media ecosystem. We're seeing that in Ukraine right now, whereby an ungodly amount of Ukrainian news sources are secretly or quietly being funded by Washington, the journalists being trained at the same time, to the point where we've really got a situation where, you know, we're at a point where, you know, the US government has an undue influence over the media of other countries, not just in terms of social media, but also in terms of legacy media too.
I wonder if any of this matters. And I don't mean that blithely. Like, does it matter that Cubans are reading fake news? Because, like, a state, like how much does it say? I guess my question is, like, what does it matter what goes on in the heads of people? Like, what they think and what they believe? Like, because we have been trained of like, you know, oh, like, you know, if enough discontent, if enough people know the truth about our society, then they'll start changing their political views, and we'll be able to organize into a stronger force and progress, blah, blah, blah. Right? Like, are we ourselves, when we say things like, oh, you know, the amount of fake news that say Cubans or say Iranians, right? Same story. Like, this is a lot of like the sort of regime change countries face the same kind of media strategy and just flooding their country with all this bullshit. And, you know, there, does it matter that people read that stuff? I used to think like, yeah, like it matters, like, you know, but other times I think like, no, it doesn't. Cause the dark side of that answer is that it doesn't matter that what we do, right? Like, it doesn't matter. Then what are we doing this for? If it doesn't matter what people think in their heads ideologically, like about, like, you know, say the Iraq war, if that doesn't translate into the illegal invasion and genocidal war on Iraq, I should say, that like, if that doesn't translate into any kind of transformational change, you know, what's the point? Right? And so these are like, I mean, I guess this is like another therapy question that I should have kept in therapy, but like, what is the point of being an info warrior when even if people's political opinions were taken into like account, like they wouldn't, right? Like, there's that famous Princeton, I think it's like a Princeton study of how undemocratic the US is, how Americans have such incredibly like low influence on their actual lives, the policies that like affect their lives, and like the one thing that gets them through is their class position, essentially. I mean, I'm adding that last part, but that's essentially that survey that, like, you know, like that, the fact that like the country that like defends human rights or like rhetorically, right, that like carries this torch of freedom is like the most unfree and like the most incarcerated, right? Like, these are just obvious facts of our society. So that like, if we can somehow, like, the fact that we're still stuck in this conversation of like exposing liberal hypocrisy, like, are we doing a disservice to ourselves and to our own energy? And so, which is to say, like, should we just not think about information war and just focus on national liberation struggles? Or is dealing with the information war a necessary and like important part of like our work?
Yeah, I mean, I think it certainly is very important that what we're doing. I guess I would answer that by saying, if it didn't matter what we think, they wouldn't be spending so many resources trying to convince us and trying to propagandize us otherwise. So, you know, if it didn't matter what we think, they wouldn't, you know, constantly be being, you know, bombarding us 24/7 with pro-war propaganda, trying to convince us that, you know, invading Libya or invading Iraq or wherever was necessary. Of course it matters. You know, Gandhi obviously famously said that, you know, politics isn't quite about, you know, convincing people that you're correct. It's more about getting them to act on what they already believe and already know to be true. And that's ultimately where the difference between journalism and activism lies. Journalism is important for laying the groundwork to try to build a sort of basic set of understanding about the world, but it really has to translate into revolutionary struggle or into activism in some way. And, you know, the United States knows this as well, so they do fund journalistic outlets, but they're also funding activists. They're also, you know, staging workshops about how to, you know, do a protest, how to get people out. You know, frankly, they're even, you know, spending money, paying people to come to protests as well. And, you know, I'll take another example. Tucker Carlson's dad, Dick Carlson, who many people don't know, was the head of Voice of America in the 1980s, when he was, you know, his job was basically to bombard Nicaragua with anti-Sandinista propaganda and bombard Eastern Europe with capitalist propaganda. He actually takes credit for the fall of the Soviet Union. He said, you know, ultimately, all these people out here on the streets of Moscow or Prague or Budapest or Warsaw, they're all chanting slogans, they're all talking about freedom and democracy. And where did they get these slogans? Where did they get this freedom and democracy talk from? It was from places like Voice of America. So ultimately, if this didn't matter, powerful people wouldn't be spending tens of billions of dollars every year on it, because, you know, they're not really in the business of just throwing away their money. So yeah, sometimes you might say, well, you know, this didn't work. It doesn't really matter what people think because, you know, the government wasn't overthrown. But it's not like that. You know, it's, you know, sometimes these protest movements work. I'm talking about progressive ones or regressive ones, either or. And sometimes they don't. But, you know, when you look back on something that did work, you think, wow, that was really worth it. Ultimately, you can't know what, you can't really know what the labors of your work are going to be. But you don't want to get to, you know, towards the end of your life and thinking, you know, I really should have done more. You're not going to get to the end of your life and think, you know, I really should have done less to try and better the world. So yeah, ultimately, media does really matter. If it didn't, they wouldn't be putting too much resources into it. We can even see what happens, you know, in my case in Great Britain. We'll talk about Jeremy Corbyn. He was the subject of an absolutely brutal media campaign, which, you know, presented him as everything from a terrorist to a threat to national security to an anti-Semite to just, you know, a baby eating monster, basically. And that had an enormous effect on how the public saw him and how likely it was that his movement was successful. Ultimately, I think he made some mistakes that were not specifically to do with the media, but certainly that played a huge role in defeating the big progressive anti-imperialist challenge, or at least a sort of social democratic challenge to capitalism in the United Kingdom. But ultimately, we can either give up or we can try again. And trying again will necessitate coming up with media outlets, trying to get the message out, as we have been doing. Certainly, there's a case of saying, are we doing this correctly? Should we be doing it in a different way? But I don't think the idea that this is all pointless really holds water.
That's a good way to end it, Alan. Thanks for your time. I appreciate it. Tell us what you're working on, where we can find more work. Tell us what does Mint Press have up its sleeve for the next coming months?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the new thing that I'm working on for Mint Press is going back into the WikiLeaks database and really looking at what WikiLeaks had to reveal about the Israel-Palestine conflict, what it had to reveal about American sources with regards to that conflict, and really understanding how much data and how much evidence that WikiLeaks gave the Palestine Solidarity Movement, and reminding people of that, and also shedding light on some new things that haven't been reported. Yeah, you can find me at Alan R. McLeod on Twitter, or you can also find me at mintpressnews.com.